From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Alamar Vance and the Vampire by Alison Claude Askew. Alamar Vance had rooms in Dover Street, Piccadilly, and now that I had decided to follow in his footsteps and to accept him as my instructor in matters psychic, I found it convenient to lodge in the same house. Alamar and I quickly became close friends, and he showed me how to develop that faculty of clairvoyance which I had possessed without being aware of it. And I may say at once that this particular faculty of mine proved of service on several important occasions. At the same time, I made myself useful to Vance in other ways, not the least of which was that of acting as recorder of his many strange adventures. For himself, he never cared much about publicity, and it was some time before I could persuade him, in the interest of science, to allow me to give any detailed account of his experiences to the world. The incidents which I will now narrate occurred very soon after we had taken up our residence together, and while I was still, so to speak, a novice. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning that a visitor was announced. He sent up a card which bore upon it the name of Paul Davenant. The name was familiar to me, and I wondered if this could be the same Mr. Davenant who was so well known for his polo playing and for his success as an amateur rider, especially over the hurdles. He was a young man of wealth and position, and I recollected that he had married about a year ago a girl who was reckoned the greatest beauty of the season. All the illustrated papers had given their portraits at the time, and I remember thinking what a remarkably handsome couple they made. Mr. Davenant was ushered in, and at first I was uncertain as to whether this could be the individual whom I had in mind. So wan and pale and ill did he appear. A finely built, upstanding man at the time of his marriage, he had now acquired a languid droop of the shoulders and a shuffling gait, while his face, especially about the lips, was bloodless to an alarming degree. And yet, it was the same man, for behind all this I could recognize the shadow of the good looks that had once distinguished Paul Davenant. He took the chair that Alamar offered him. After the usual preliminary civilities had been exchanged, and then glanced doubtfully in my direction. "I wish to consult you privately, Mr. Vance," he said. "The matter is of considerable importance to myself, and, if I may say so, of a somewhat delicate nature." Of course, I rose immediately to withdraw from the room, but Vance laid his hand upon my arm. "If the matter is connected with research in my particular line, Mr. Davenant," he said, "if there is any investigation you wish me to take up on your behalf, I shall be glad if you will include Mr. Dexter in your confidence. Mr. Dexter assists me in my work, but of course..." "Oh no," interrupted the other. "If that is the case, pray let Mr. Dexter remain. I think," he added, glancing at me with a friendly smile, "that you are an Oxford man, are you not, Mr. Dexter?" "It was before my time, but I have heard of your name in connection with the river. You rode at Henley, unless I am very much mistaken." I admitted the fact with a pleasurable sensation of pride. I was very keen upon rowing in those days, and a man's prowess at school and college always remained dear to his heart. After this we quickly became on friendly terms, and Paul Davenant proceeded to take Alamar and myself into his confidence. He began by calling attention to his personal appearance. "You would hardly recognize me for the same man I was a year ago," he said. "I've been losing flesh steadily for the last 6 months. I came up from Scotland about a week ago to consult a London doctor. I've seen two, in fact. They've held a sort of consultation over me. but the result, I may say, is far from satisfactory. They don't seem to know what is really the matter with me. Anemia? Heart, suggested Vance. He was scrutinizing his visitor keenly and yet without any particular appearance of doing so. I believe it is not infrequently happens that you, athletes, overdo yourselves, put too much strain upon the heart. My heart is quite sound, responded Davenant. Physically it is in perfect condition. The trouble seems to be that it hasn't enough blood to pump into my veins. The doctors wanted to know if I had met with an accident involving a great loss of blood. But I haven't. I've had no accident at all. And as for anemia, well, I don't seem to show the ordinary symptoms of it. The inexplicable thing is that I've lost blood without knowing it, and apparently this has been going on for some time, for I've been getting steadily worse. It was almost imperceptible at first. Not a sudden collapse, you understand, but a gradual failure of health. I wonder, remarked Van slowly, what induced you to consult me? For you know, of course, the direction in which I pursue my investigations. May I ask if you have reason to consider that your state of health is due to some cause which we may describe as superphysical? A slight color came to Davenant's white cheeks. There are curious circumstances, he said in a low and earnest tone of voice. I've been turning them over in my mind, trying to see light through them. I dare say it's all the sheerest folly, and I must tell you that I'm not in the least a superstitious sort of a man. I don't mean to say that I'm absolutely incredulous, but I've never given thought to such things. I've led too active a life. But, as I've said, there are curious circumstances about my case, and that is why I decided upon consulting you. Will you tell me everything without reserve, said Vance. I could see that he was still interested. He was sitting up in his chair, his feet supported on a stool, his elbows on his knees, his chin in his hands. A favorite attitude of his. Have you, he suggested slowly, any mark upon your body, anything that you might associate, however remotely, with your present weakness and ill health? It's a curious thing that you should ask me that question, returned Davenant, because I have got a curious mark, a sort of scar, that I can't account for. But I showed it to the doctors, and they assured me that it could have nothing whatever to do with my condition. In any case, if it had, it was something altogether outside their experience. I think they imagined it to be nothing more than a birthmark, a sort of mole, for they asked me if I'd had it all my life. But that I can swear I haven't. I only noticed it for the first time about 6 months ago, when my health began to fail. But you can see for yourself. He loosened his collar and bared his throat. Vance rose and made a careful scrutiny of the suspicious mark. It was situated a very little to the left of the central line, just above the clavicle, and as Vance pointed out, directly over the big vessels of the throat. My friend called to me so that I might examine it too. Whatever the opinion of the doctors may have been, Almer was obviously deeply interested. And yet there was very little to show. The skin was quite intact, and there was no sign of inflammation. There were two red marks, about an inch apart, each of which was inclined to be crescent in shape. They were more visible than they might otherwise have been owing to the peculiar whiteness of Davenant's skin. It can't be anything of importance, said Davenant with a slightly uneasy laugh. I'm inclined to think the marks are dying away. Have you ever noticed them more inflamed than they are at present? Inquired Vance. If so, was it at any special time? Davenant reflected. Yes, he replied slowly. There have been times, usually, I think perhaps invariably, when I wake up in the morning, that I've noticed them larger and more angry looking, and I've felt a slight sensation of pain, a tingling, a very slight, and I've never worried about it. Only now you suggest it to my mind, I believe that those same mornings I have felt particularly tired and done up, a sensation of lassitude absolutely unusual to me. And once, Mr. Vance, I remember quite distinctly that there was a stain of blood close to the mark. I didn't think anything of it at the time, and just wiped it away. I see. Almor Vance resumed his seat and invited his visitor to do the same. And now, he resumed, you said, Mr. Davenant, that there are certain peculiar circumstances you wish to acquaint me with. Will you do so? And so Davenant readjusted his collar and proceeded to tell his story. I will tell it as far as I can, without any reference to the occasional interruptions of Vance and myself. Paul Davenant, as I have said, was a man of wealth and position, and so in every sense of the word he was a suitable husband for Miss Jessica McThane, the young woman who eventually became his wife. Before coming to the incident attending his loss of health, he had a great deal to recount about Miss McThane and her family history. She was of Scottish descent, and although she had certain characteristics, features of her race, she was not really Scotch in appearance. Hers was the beauty of the far south rather than that of the highlands from which she had her origin. Names are not always suited to their owners, and Miss McThane's was peculiarly inappropriate. She had in fact been christened Jessica in a sort of pathetic effort to counteract her obvious departure from normal type. There was a reason for this which we were soon to learn. Miss McThane was especially remarkable for her wonderful red hair, hair such as one hardly ever sees outside of Italy. Not the Celtic red. It was so long that it reached to her feet, and it had an extraordinary gloss upon it, so that it seemed almost to have individual life of its own. Then, she had just a complexion that one would expect with such hair, the purest ivory white, and not in the least marred by freckles, as is so often the case with red-haired girls. Her beauty was derived from an ancestress who had been brought to Scotland from some foreign shore. No one really knew exactly whence. Davenant fell in love with her almost at once, and he had every reason to believe, in spite of her many admirers, that his love was returned. At this time he knew very little about her personal history. He was aware only that she was very wealthy in her own right, an orphan, and the last representative of a race that had once been famous in the annals of history, or rather, infamous, for the McThanes had distinguished themselves more by cruelty and lust of blood than by the deeds of chivalry, a clan of turbulent robbers in the past that had helped to add many a bloodstained page to the history of their country. Jessica had lived with her father, who owned a house in London, until his death when she was about 15 years of age. Her mother had died in Scotland when Jessica was still a tiny child. Mr. McThane had been so affected by his wife's death that, with his little daughter, he had abandoned his Scotch estate altogether, or so it was believed, leaving it to the management of a bailiff, though indeed there was but little work for the bailiff to do, since there were practically no tenants left. Blackwick Castle had borne for many years a most unenviable reputation. After the death of her father, Miss McThane had gone to live with a certain Mrs. Meredith, who was a connection of her mother's. On her father's side, she had not a single relation left. Jessica was absolutely the last of a clan, once so extensive that intermarriage had been a tradition of the family, but for which the last 200 years had been gradually dwindling to extinction. Mrs. Meredith took Jessica into society, which would never have been her privilege had Mr. McThane lived, for he was a moody, self-absorbed man, and prematurely old, one who seemed worn down by the weight of a great grief. Well, I have said that Paul Davenant quickly fell in love with Jessica, and it was not long before he proposed for her hand. To his great surprise, for he had good reason to believe that she cared for him, he met with a refusal. Nor would she give any explanation, though she burst into a flood of pitiful tears. Bewildered and bitterly disappointed, he consulted Mrs. Meredith, with whom he happened to be on friendly terms, and from her he learnt that Jessica had already had several proposals, all from quite desirable men, but that one after another had been rejected. Paul consoled himself with the reflection that perhaps Jessica did not love them, whereas he was quite sure that she cared for himself. Under these circumstances, he determined to try again. He did so, and with better result. Jessica admitted her love, but at the same time, she repeated that she would not marry him. Love and marriage were not for her, Then, to his utter amazement, she declared that she had been born under a curse which sooner or later was bound to show itself in her, and which, moreover, must react cruelly, perhaps fatally, upon anyone with whom she linked her life. How could she allow a man she loved to take such a risk? Above all, since the evil was hereditary, there was one point upon which she had quite made up her mind. No child should ever call her mother. She must be the last of her race indeed. Of course, Davenant was amazed and inclined to think that Jessica had got some absurd idea into her head, which a little reasoning on his part would dispel. There was only one other possible explanation. Was it lunacy she was afraid of? But Jessica shook her head. She did not know of any lunacy in her family. The ill was deeper, more subtle than that. And then she told them all that she knew. The curse. She made us of that word for want of a better. Was attached to the ancient race from which she had her origin. Her father had suffered from it, and his father and grandfather before him. All three had taken to themselves young wives who had died mysteriously of some wasting disease within a few years. Had they observed the ancient family tradition of intermarriage, this might possibly not have happened, but in their case, since the family was so near extinction, this had not been possible. For the curse, or whatever it was, did not kill those who bore the name of MacThane. It only rendered them a danger to others. It was as if they absorbed from the blood-soaked walls of their fatal castle a deadly taint which reacted terribly upon those with whom they were brought into contact, especially their nearest and dearest. "Do you know what my father said? We have it in us to become," said Jessica with a shudder. "He used the word vampires. Paul, think of it. Vampires. Preying upon the lifeblood of others." And then, when Davenant was inclined to laugh, and she checked him, "No," she cried out, "it is not impossible. Think. We are a decadent race. From the earliest times our history has been marked by bloodshed and cruelty. The walls of Blackwick Castle are impregnated with evil. Every stone could tell its tale of violence, pain, lust, and murder. What can one expect of those who have spent their lifetime between its walls?"
"But you have not done so," exclaimed Paul.
"You have been spared that, Jessica. You were taken away after your mother died, and you have no recollection of Blackwick Castle. None at all.
And you need never set foot in it again."
"I'm afraid the evil is in my blood," she replied sadly, "although I am unconscious of it now. And as for not returning to Blackwick, I'm not sure I can help myself. At least, that is what my father warned me of. He said there is something there, some compelling force that will call me to it in spite of myself. But, oh, I don't know, and that is what makes it so difficult. If I could only believe that all this is nothing but an idle superstition, I might be happy again, for I have it in me to enjoy life, and I'm young, very young. But my father told me these things when he was on his deathbed," she added the last words in a low, awe-stricken tone. Paul pressed her to tell him all that she knew, and eventually she revealed another fragment of family history which seemed to have some bearing upon the case. It dealt with her own astonishing likeness to that ancestress of a couple of hundred years ago, whose existence seemed to have presaged the gradual downfall of the clan of the MacThanes. A certain Robert MacThane, departing from the traditions of his family, which demanded that he should not marry outside his clan, brought home a wife from foreign shores, a woman of wonderful beauty, who was possessed of glowing masses of red hair and a complexion of ivory whiteness, such as had more or less distinguished since then every female of the race born in the direct line. It was not long before this woman came to be regarded in the neighborhood as a witch. Queer stories were circulated abroad as to her doings, and the reputation of Blackwick Castle became worse than ever before. And then one day she disappeared. Robert MacThane had been absent upon some business for 24 hours, and it was upon his return that he found her gone. The neighborhood was searched,
but without avail, and then Robert, who was a violent man and who had adored his foreign wife, called together certain of his tenants, whom he suspected, rightly or wrongly, of foul play, and had them murdered in cold blood. Murder was easy in those days. Yet such an outcry was raised that Robert had to take flight, leaving his two children in the care of their nurse, and for a long while Blackwick Castle was without a master. But its evil reputation persisted. It was said that Zeta, the witch, though dead, still made her presence felt. Many children of the tenantry and young people in the neighborhood sickened and died, possibly of quite natural causes. But this did not prevent a mantle of terror settling upon the countryside, for it was said that Zeta had been seen, a pale woman, clad in white, flitting about the cottages at night, and where she passed, sickness and death were sure to supervene. And from that time the fortune of the family gradually declined. Heir succeeded heir, but no sooner was he installed at Blackwick Castle than his nature, whatever it may previously have been, seemed to undergo a change. It was as if he'd absorbed into himself all the weight of evil that had stained his family name, as if he'd indeed become a vampire, bringing blight upon any not directly connected with his own house. And so by degrees Blackwick was deserted of his tenantry. The land around it was left uncultivated. The farm stood empty. This had persisted to the present day, for the superstitious peasantry still told their tales of the mysterious white woman who hovered about the neighborhood, and whose appearance betokened death, and possibly worse than death. And yet it seemed that the last representative of the McThanes could not desert their ancestral home. Riches they had, sufficient to live happily upon elsewhere, but drawn by some power they could not contend against, they had preferred to spend their lives in the solitude of the now half-ruined castle, shunned by their neighbors, feared and execrated by the few tenants that still clung to their soil. So it had been with Jessica's grandfather and great-grandfather. Each of them had married a young wife, and each case their love story had been all too brief. The vampire spirit was still abroad, expressing itself, or so it seemed, through the living representatives of bygone generations of evil, and young blood had been demanded as the sacrifice. And to them had succeeded Jessica's father. He had not profited by their example, but had followed directly in their footsteps. And the same fate had befallen the wife whom he passionately adored. She had died of pernicious anemia, so the doctor said, but he had regarded himself as her murderer. But unlike his predecessors, he had torn himself away from Blackwick, and this for the sake of his child. Unknown to her, however, he had returned year after year, for there were times when the passionate longing for the gloomy, mysterious halls and corridors of the old castle, for the wild stretches of moorland and the dark pine woods, would come upon him too strongly to be resisted. And so he knew that for his daughter, as for himself, there was no escape. And he warned her, when the relief of death was at last granted to him, of what her fate must be. This was the tale that Jessica told the man who wished to make her his wife, and he made light of it, as such a man would, regarding it all as foolish superstition, the delusions of a mind overwrought. And at last, perhaps it was not very difficult, for she loved him with all her heart and soul. He succeeded in inducing Jessica to think as he did, to banish morbid ideas, as he called them, from her brain, and to consent to marry him at an early date. "I'll take any risk you like," he declared. "I'll even go and live at Blackwick if you should so desire it. To think of you, my lovely Jessica, a vampire? Why, I never heard such nonsense in my life." "Father said I am very like Zeta the witch," she protested, but he silenced her with a kiss. And so they were married and spent their honeymoon abroad, and in the autumn Paul accepted an invitation to a house party in Scotland for the grouse shooting, a sport to which he was absolutely devoted, and Jessica agreed with him that there was no reason why he should forego his pleasure. Perhaps it was an unwise thing to do, to venture to Scotland, but by the time the young couple, more deeply in love with each other than ever, had got quite over their fears, Jessica was redolent with health and spirits, and more than once she declared that if they should be anywhere in the neighborhood of Blackwick, she would like to see the old castle out of curiosity, and just to show how absolutely she had got over the foolish terrors that used to assail her. This seemed to Paul to be quite a wise plan. And so one day, since they were actually staying at no great distance, they motored over to Blackwick, and finding the bailiff got him to show them over the castle. It was a great castellated pile, gray with age and in places falling into ruins. It stood on a steep hillside, with a rock of which it seemed to form part, and on one side of it there was a precipitous drop to a mountain stream 100 feet below. The robber MacThanes of the old days could not have desired a better stronghold. At the back, climbing up the mountainside, were dark pine woods, from which, here and there, rugged crags protruded, and these were fantastically shaped, some like gigantic and misshapen human forms, which stood up as if they mounted guard over the castle and the narrow gorge by which alone it could be approached. This gorge was always full of weird, uncanny sounds. It might have been a storehouse for the wind, which even on calm days rushed up and down as if seeking an escape, and it moaned among the pines and whistled in the crags and shouted derisive laughter as it was tossed from side to side of the rocky heights. It was like the plaint of lost souls. That is the expression Davenant made use of. The plaint of lost souls. The road, little more than a track now, passed through this gorge, and then, after skirting a small but steep lake, which hardly knew the light of the sun, so shut in was it by overhanging trees, climbed the hill to the castle. And the castle. Davenant used but a few words to describe it, yet somehow I could see the gloomy edifice in my mind's eye, and something of the lurking horror that it contained communicated itself to my brain. Perhaps my clairvoyant sense assisted me, for when he spoke of them, I seemed already acquainted with the great stone halls, the long corridors, gloomy and cold even on the brightest and warmest of days, the dark oak-paneled room, and the broad central staircase up which one of the early MacThanes had once led a dozen men on horseback in pursuit of a stag which had taken refuge within the precincts of the castle. There was the keep, too, its walls so thick that the ravages of time had made no impression upon them. And beneath the keep were dungeons, which could tell terrible tales of ancient wrong and lingering pain. Well, Mr. and Mrs. Davenant visited as much as the bailiff could show them of this ill-omened edifice, and Paul, for his part, thought pleasantly of his own Derbyshire home, the fine Georgian mansion, replete with every modern comfort, where he proposed to settle with his wife. And so he received something of a shock when, as they drove away, she slipped her hand into his and whispered, "Paul, you promised, didn't you, that you would refuse me nothing?" She had been strangely silent till she spoke those words. Paul, slightly apprehensive, assured her that she only had to ask. But the speech did not come from his heart, for he guessed vaguely what she desired. She wanted to go and live at the castle. Oh, only for a little while, for she was sure she would soon tire of it. But the bailiff had told her that there were papers, documents, which she ought to examine, since the property was now hers, and besides, she was interested in this home of her ancestors and wanted to explore it more thoroughly. Oh no, she wasn't in the least influenced by the old superstition. That wasn't the attraction. She had quite got over those silly ideas. Paul had cured her, and since he himself was so convinced that they were without foundation, he ought not to mind granting her her whim. This was a plausible argument, not easy to controvert. In the end, Paul yielded, though it was not without a struggle. He suggested amendments. Let him at least have the place done up for her. That would take time, or let them postpone their visit till next year, in the summer, not move in just as the winter was upon them. But Jessica did not want to delay longer than she could help, and she hated the idea of redecoration. Why, it would spoil the illusion of the old place, and besides, it would be a waste of money since she only wished to remain there for a week or two. The Derbyshire house was not quite ready yet. They must allow time for the paper to dry on the walls. And so, a week later, When their stay with their friends was concluded, they went to Blackwick, the bailiff having engaged a few raw servants and generally made things as comfortable for them as possible. Paul was worried and apprehensive, but he could not admit this to his wife after having so loudly proclaimed his theories on the subject of superstition. They had been married 3 months at this time. 9 had passed since then, and they had never left Blackwick for more than a few hours. Till now, Paul had come to London, alone. Over and over again, he declared, "My wife has begged me to go. With tears in her eyes, almost upon her knees, she has entreated me to leave her, but I have steadily refused unless she'll accompany me." "But that is a trouble, Mr. Vance. She cannot. There is something, some mysterious horror, that holds her there as surely as if she were bound with fetters. It holds her more strongly even than it held her father. We found out that he used to spend 6 months at least of every year at Blackwick, months when he pretended that he was traveling abroad. You see, the spell, or whatever the accursed thing may be, never really relaxed its grip of him." "Did you ever attempt to take your wife away?" asked Vance. "Yes, several times, but it was hopeless. She would become so ill as soon as we were beyond the limit of the estate that I invariably had to take her back. Once we got as far as Dorkirk. That is the nearest town, you know, and I thought I should be successful if only I could get her through the night. But she escaped me. She climbed out of a window. She meant to go back on foot at night, all those long miles. Then I have had doctors down, but it is I who wanted the doctors, not she. They have ordered me away, but I have refused to obey them till now." "Is your wife changed at all, physically?" interrupted Vance. Davenant reflected. "Changed?" he said. "Yes, but so subtly that I hardly know how to describe it. She is more beautiful than ever, and yet it isn't the same beauty, if you can understand me. I have spoken of her white complexion. Well, one is more than ever conscious of it now, because her lips have become so red. They are almost like a splash of blood upon her face. And the upper one has a peculiar curve that I don't think it had before. And when she laughs, she doesn't smile. Do you know what I mean? Then her hair has lost its wonderful gloss. Of course, I know she is fretting about me, but that is so peculiar, too. For at times, as I have told you, she will implore me to go and leave her, and then perhaps only a few minutes later, she will wreathe her arms around my neck and say she cannot live without me. And I feel that there is a struggle going on within her, that she is only yielding slowly to the horrible influence, whatever it is, that she is herself when she begs me to go, but when she entreats me to stay, and it is then that her fascination is most intense. Oh, I can't help remembering what she told me before we were married, and that word," he lowered his voice, "the word vampire." He passed his hand over his brow that was wet with perspiration. "But that's absurd, ridiculous," he muttered. "These fantastic beliefs have been exploded years ago. We live in the 20th century. A pod ensued, then Vance said quietly, "Mr. Davenant, since you have taken me into your confidence, since you have found doctors of no avail, will you let me try to help you? I think I may be of some use, if it is not already too late. Should you agree, Mr. Dexter and I will accompany you, as you have suggested, to Blackwick Castle, as early as possible by tonight's mail north. Under ordinary circumstances, I should tell you, as you value your life, not to return." Davenant shook his head. "That is advice which I should never undertake," he declared. "I had already decided, under any circumstances, to travel north tonight. I am glad that you both will accompany me." And so was decided. We settled to meet at the station, and presently Paul Davenant took his departure. Any other details that remained to be told, he would put us in possession of during the course of the journey. "A curious and most interesting case," remarked Vance, when we were alone. "What do you make of it, Dexter?" "I suppose," I replied cautiously, "that there is such a thing as vampirism, even in these days of advanced civilization. I can understand the evil influence that a very old person may have upon a young one if they happen to be in constant intercourse. the worn-out tissue sapping healthy vitality for their own support. And there are certain people, I could think of several myself, who seem to depress me, one, and undermine one's energies, quite unconsciously, of course, but one feels somehow that vitality has passed from oneself to them. And in this case, when the force is centuries old, expressing itself in some mysterious way through Davenant's wife, it is not feasible to believe that he may be physically affected by it, even though the whole thing is sheerly mental.
You think then, demanded Vance, that it is sheerly mental?
Tell me, if that is so, how do you account for the marks on Davenant's throat?
This was a question to which I found no reply, and though I pressed him for his views, Vance would not commit himself further just then.
Of our long journey to Scotland, I need say nothing. We did not reach Blackwick Castle till late in the afternoon of the following day. The place was just as I had conceived it, as I have already described it, and a sense of gloom settled upon me as our car jolted us over the rough road that led through the Gorge of the Winds, a gloom that deepened when we penetrated into the vast cold hall of the castle. Mrs. Davenant, who had been informed by telegram of our arrival, received us cordially. She knew nothing of our actual mission, regarding us merely as friends of her husband's. She was most solicitous on our behalf, but there was something strained about her tone, and it made me feel vaguely uneasy. The impression that I got was that the woman was impelled to everything that she said or did by some force outside herself. But of course, this was a conclusion that the circumstances I was aware of might easily have conduced to. In every other aspect she was charming, and she had an extraordinary fascination of appearance and manner that made me readily understand the force of a remark made by Davenant during our journey. I want to live for Jessica's sake. Get her away from Blackwick. Vance and I feel that all will be well. I'd go through hell to have her restored to me, as she was. And now that I have seen Mrs. Davenant, I realize what he meant by those last words. Her fascination was stronger than ever, but it was not a natural fascination, not that of a normal woman, such as she had been. It was a fascination of a Circe, of a witch, of an enchantress, and as such was irresistible. We had a strong proof of the evil within her soon after our arrival. It was a test that Vance had quietly prepared. Davenant had mentioned that no flowers grew at Blackwick, and Vance declared that we must take some with us as a present for the lady of the house. He purchased a bouquet of pure white roses at the little town where we left the train, for the motor car had been sent to meet us. Soon after our arrival, he presented these to Mrs. Davenant. She took them, it seemed to me, nervously, and hardly had her hand touched them before they fell to pieces in a shower of crumpled petals to the floor. "We must act at once," said Vance to me when we were descending to dinner that night. "There must be no delay." "What are you afraid of?" I whispered. "Davenant has been absent a week," he replied grimly. "He is stronger than when he went away, but not strong enough to survive the loss of more blood. He must be protected. There is danger tonight." "You mean from his wife?"
I shuddered at the ghastliness of the suggestion.
"That is what time will show." Vance turned to me and added a few words with intense earnestness.
"Mrs. Davenant, Dexter, is at present hovering between two conditions. The evil thing has not yet completely mastered her. You remember what Davenant said, how she would beg him to go away, and the next moment entreat him to stay? She has made a struggle, but she is gradually succumbing, and this last week, spent here alone, has strengthened the evil, and that is what I've got to fight. Dexter, it is to be a contest of will, a contest that will go on silently till one or the other obtains the mastery. If you watch, you may see. Should a change show itself in Mrs. Davenant, you will know that I have won." Thus I knew the direction in which my friend proposed to act. It was to be a war of his will against the mysterious power that had laid its curse upon the house of MacThane. Mrs. Davenant must be released from the fatal charm that held her. And I, knowing
what was going on, was able to watch and understand. I realized that the silent contest had begun even while we ate dinner. Mrs. Davenant ate practically nothing and seemed ill at ease. She fidgeted in her chair, talked a great deal, and laughed. It was the laugh without a smile, as Davenant had described it. And as soon as she was able to, she withdrew. Later, as we sat in the drawing room, I could feel the clash of wills. The air in the room felt electric and heavy, charged with tremendous but invisible forces. And outside, round the castle, the wind whistled and shrieked and moaned. It was as if all the dead and gone MacThanes, a grim army, had collected to fight the battle of their race. And all this while, we four in the drawing room were sitting and talking the ordinary commonplaces of after-dinner conversation. That was the extraordinary part of it. Paul Davenant suspected nothing, and I, who knew, had to play my part. But I hardly took my eyes from Jessica's face. When would the change come, or was it indeed too late? At last Davenant rose and remarked that he was tired and would go to bed. There was no need for Jessica to hurry. We would sleep that night in his dressing room and did not want to be disturbed. And it was at that moment, as his lips met hers in a good-night kiss, as she wreathed her enchantress arms about him, careless of our presence, her eyes gleaming hungrily, that the change came. It came with a fierce and threatening shriek of wind and a rattling of the casement, as if the horde of ghosts without was about to break in upon us. A long, quivering sigh escaped from Jessica's lips. Her arms fell from her husband's shoulder, and she drew back, swaying a little from side to side. "Paul," she cried, and somehow the whole timbre of her voice was changed. "What a wretch I've been to bring you back to Blackwick, ill as you are. But we'll go away, dear. Yes, I'll go too. Oh, will you take me away? Take me away tomorrow?" She spoke with an intense earnestness, unconscious all the time of what had been happening to her. Long shudders were convulsing her frame. "I don't know why I wanted to stay here," she kept repeating. "I hate the place, really. It's evil, evil." Having heard those words, I exulted, for surely Vance's success was assured. But I was to learn that the danger was not yet past. Husband and wife separated, each going to their own room. I noticed a grateful, if mystified, glance that Davenant threw at Vance, vaguely aware, as he must have been, that my friend was somehow responsible for what had happened. It was settled that plans for departure were to be discussed by the morrow. "I have succeeded," Vance said hurriedly, when we were alone, "but the change may be a transitory. I must keep watch tonight." "Go you to bed, Dexter. There is nothing that you can do." I obeyed, though I would sooner have kept watch too. Watched against a danger of which I had no understanding, I went to my room, a gloomy and sparsely furnished apartment, but I knew that it was quite impossible for me to think of sleeping. And so, dressed as I was, I went and sat by the open window, for now the wind that had raged around the castle had died down to a low moaning in the pine trees, a whimpering of time-worn agony. And it was as I sat thus that I became aware of a white figure that stole out from the castle by a door that I could not see, and with hands clasped, ran swiftly across the terrace to the wood. I had but a momentary glance, but I felt convinced that the figure was that of Jessica Davenant. And instinctively, I knew that some great danger was imminent. It was, I think, the suggestion of despair conveyed by those clasped hands. At any rate, I did not hesitate. My window was some height from the ground, but the wall below was ivy-clad and afforded good foothold. The descent was quite easy. I achieved it, and was just in time to take up the pursuit in the right direction, which was into the thickness of the wood that clung to the slope of the hill. I shall never forget that wild chase. There was just sufficient room to enable me to follow the rough path, which luckily, since I had now lost sight of my quarry, was the only possible way that she could have taken. There was no intersecting tracks, and the wood was too thick on either side to permit of deviation, and the wood seemed full of dreadful sounds. Moaning and wailing and hideous laughter, the wind, of course, and the screaming of night birds. Once I felt the fluttering of wings close proximity to my face, but I could not rid myself of the thought that I in my turn was being pursued, that the forces of hell were combined against me. The path came to an abrupt end on the border of the somber lake that I have already mentioned, and now I realize that I was indeed only just in time, for before me, plunging knee-deep in the water, I recognize the white-clad figure of the woman I had been pursuing. Hearing my footsteps, she turned her head and then threw up her arms and screamed. Her red hair fell in heavy masses about her shoulders, and her face, as I saw it in that moment, was hardly human for the agony of remorse that it depicted. "Go," she cried, "for God's sake, let me die." But I was by her side almost as she spoke. She struggled with me, sought vainly to tear herself from my clasp, implored me with panting breath to let her drown. "It's the only way to save him," she gasped. "Don't you understand that I am a thing cursed? For it is I who have sapped his lifeblood. I know it now. The truth has been revealed to me tonight. I am a vampire, without hope in this world or the next. So for his sake, for the sake of his unborn child, let me die. Let me die." Was ever so terribly an appeal made? Yet I, what could I do? Gently, I overcame her resistance and drew her back to shore. By the time I reached it, she was lying a dead weight upon my arm. I laid her down upon a mossy bank, and kneeling by her side, gazed intently into her face. And then I knew that I had done well, for the face I looked upon was not that of Jessica the vampire. As I had seen it that afternoon, it was the face of Jessica the woman whom Paul Devenant had loved. And later, Almer Vance had his tale to tell. "I waited," he said, "until I knew that Devenant was asleep, and then I stole into his room to watch by his bedside. And presently she came, as I guessed she would. The vampire, the cursed thing that has preyed upon the souls of her kin, making them like to herself when they too have passed into Shadowland, and gathering sustenance for her horrid task from the blood of those who are alien to her race. Paul's body and Jessica's soul, it is for one and the other, Dexter, that we have fought." "You mean," I hesitated, "Zeta the witch?" "Even so," he agreed. "Hers is the evil spirit that has fallen like a blight upon the house of MacThane. But now I think she may be exorcised forever." "Tell me." "She came to Paul Devenant last night, as she must have been done before, in the guise of his wife. You know that Jessica bears a strong resemblance to her ancestress. He opened his arms, but she was foiled of her prey, for I had taken my precautions. I had placed that upon Davenant's breast while he slept, which robbed the vampire of her power of ill. She sped wailing from the room, a shadow. She who a minute before had looked at him with Jessica's eyes and spoken to him with Jessica's voice. Her red lips were Jessica's lips, and they were close to his when his eyes were open and he saw her as she was, a hideous phantom of the corruption of the ages. So the spell was removed, and she fled away to a place whence she had come." He paused, and now I inquired. "Blackwick Castle must be razed to the ground," he replied. "That is the only way. Every stone of it, every brick, must be ground to powder and burnt with fire, for therein is the cause of all the evil. Davenant has consented."
"And Mrs. Davenant?"
"I think," Vance answered cautiously, "that all may be well with her. The curse will be removed with the destruction of the castle. She has not, thanks to you, perished under its influence. She was less guilty than she imagined, herself preyed upon rather than praying. But can't you understand her remorse when she realized, as she was bound to realize, the part she has played, and the knowledge of the child to come, its fatal inheritance?" "I understand," I muttered with a shudder, and then, under my breath, I whispered, "Thank God."